No, I just know that, well, the medical team, there's a medical mission that does go to South America.
Right, yeah.
But that's all I know,
Yeah.
you know, so.
It's quite amazing, you know, how far the Japanese doctors go and how far and spread out survivors are. Yeah.
So it's, and it, that's about all I know, so,
Yeah. So maybe you can start by telling me a little bit about how you started to get involved in your work for
With the survivors
survivors.
here.
Yeah.
This was kind of in the early 1980s, in fact, late 70s, when my husband was working with the American Friends Service Committee in Honolulu. And so we were kind of involved in some anti-nuclear activities there. And one of the activities, or one of the things we were involved in, was the Nuclear Free and Independent Pacific Movement. And kind of like you, you know, I had read, there was an article in the newspaper that had been written by someone who had worked with A-bomb survivors in Los Angeles. And my reaction was, oh, you know, like you, kind of, well, I was surprised that I never thought of A-bomb survivors, U.S. survivors living in the United States, and then learning that there were U.S. citizens, you know, who were survivors. And so I just kind of clipped the article and just kind of kept it. No, I kept it, and then I think there was just a reference to the, I'm not sure it was to JACL or the A-bomb survivors group at that time, CABS. But I think I wrote a letter just to say, oh, you know, I read the article, and if there's anything that I can do here in Hawaii to, you know, I don't know, whatever, I can help, whatever, you know, let me know.
So you wrote to CAPS rather than JACL.
I'm not sure whether the article was from CABS or JACL. I
Oh,
mean,
the
it was
article
such a long
itself.
time. Yeah. So one of those, and I'm not sure to which, and may have been to CABS, but then I'm not sure. And then it was just kind of, and I even don't know what year that was in.
But your guess would be sometime in the
Late
late
70s,
1970s.
because
Yeah,
in
makes sense.
1980 is when I began to get involved with Mr. Hirano. So it must have been, you know, it would have been kind of just before 1980.
And was 1980 the first year when the Hiroshima doctors came to Hawaii?
1981 was the first year. And
81.
the reason I mentioned 1980 was Dr. Makinodan, who was with the Veterans Administration, he was doing, I think, a research project and was conducting some interviews with A-bomb survivors. And he had come to Honolulu, and so to kind of help, or not organize, but to help kind of put him in touch with the survivors here, I was involved with that. And so that's kind of my, you know, the first time we did something with kind of the survivors group with someone else. And I guess I did. I'm not paying attention to dates and times because it's like, you know, just something that you happen to work with. But 1980, I mean, I remember that. I mean, that stuck in my mind because that was the first time with the survivors group in Honolulu anything was done. So at any rate, in, I guess it was also 1980, around there, there was a Nuclear Free and Independent Pacific Conference on Oahu, and I was involved with that. And I met someone from Los Angeles, Nancy Terasaki, I think. She was with the Agape group, and she had come over, you know, to be involved with for the conference. And she somehow had my name also, and Mr. Hirano's name, because she knew Kaz in Los Angeles, and I'm not sure what other connection she had. But anyway, when she came over to Honolulu, she got in touch with me, and it was through her that I met Mr. Hirano.
Okay.
And
so Hirano was already active in...
He was active in a sense of he and Kaz knew each other.
Right, okay.
And Kaz was, you know, had been involved from, I think, the late 70s with the Survivors Group. And and one of the things I learned was that in order for the Hawaii survivors to get the kind of medical attention that the mainland survivors were getting, they needed to organize as a group here.
Right, right.
And so I think that's what I learned from Nancy. And so it was kind of... that need and kind of Nancy conveying, I guess, that message to me and my meeting Mr. Hirano, that I kind of became involved with Mr. Hirano, and then from there, taking that and trying to identify survivors here, survivors, and kind of, quote, organize them. Identify them as a group. That happened kind of like in 1980, yeah. And so we set up from that initial meeting, we set up a number of meetings over the years when we would meet and kind of just meet and talk and share information. And then we, you know, kind of slowly built our list of people we identified here. And then in 1981, because we had a group that was affiliated with the CABS group Los Angeles, the medical team, when they came over in 81, they stopped in Honolulu.
Right.
And provided just consultations at that time, and that was the first time. And then, so when they came 2 years later in 83, that's when they did full exams.
Ah, okay. Yeah. But it was not a treatment, as I understand it. It's just full, careful examination.
It's just, an examination. And my understanding, based on you know, what I've read and even like the letters that now go out from the Hiroshima Prefectural Medical Association, and, you know, saying that the next medical mission is happening. It's mainly from what the earlier word was, a humanitarian effort by the Japanese government. Well, initially by the Hiroshima government, and later on with the Japanese government being involved financially.
Right.
And the purpose is to kind of allow or provide the survivors here with someone to talk to, especially in Japanese, since for a lot of them that's their first language and that's what they're most comfortable with. And I'm also presuming that's also what they can kind of better express their concerns, and you know, if they have any questions, you know, if they can kind of ask them more clearly, I think, in Japanese. And so having the Japanese doctors here, and also being familiar with working with survivors, you know, in Japan, I think that allowed our survivors to feel a little more comfortable talking about their concerns, and, you know, and be able to ask questions that they had.
So
it's not anything from my understanding, it's been more of providing them with that need to talk about their concerns and questions, and also providing them with the kind of the, you know, the various lab tests and the exams, so that if to kind of how should I say it? I guess help the survivors with their health care, and kind of just, you know, point out if something looks a little out of the normal, you know, so that they can get it checked on by their personal physician here.
Right. Do you think the exams actually serve for the stated purpose?
I think so, because based on just kind of, you know, slowly, I mean, over the years, just talking to the survivors when they come for the exams, there's a sense of comfort that they can talk to someone about their concerns, and they feel that their concerns are being listened to, versus talking to a local doctor and not getting the sense that, you know, their concern is a real concern. And I think that psychological support, I think, has been really helpful. And
Now I think that one thing I'm learning from many survivors I talk to, if not all, is that in addition to being comforted or being able to be listened to by somebody who is really familiar with dealing with this type of issues related to irradiation, they also feel that it's easier to talk to Japanese doctors because American doctors may be biased against them, or they themselves may be made uncomfortable by realizing how, oh, you are the survivors of the bomb that my country used.
Is that something you get from the mainland survivors, or have you heard from that from our local survivors?
I think mostly from mainland survivors, but I don't really know. I have only seven people that I talked to who are living in Hawaii, so most of my source of information is from mainland. Do you feel it's the case?
I've heard I guess when, you know, and that's what I've heard for the mainland survivors, and I always think that, and I tend to think that Hawaii survivors are not not so much like the thinking of the mainland survivors, and but it's just my thinking. I don't have any anecdotes to support that, but I know that on the mainland, there's, you know, there being a minority on the mainland, I think does affect how they see themselves or to see how they relate to their doctor. Whereas here, we're not really, we're not a minority. I think we're just a little, I have a thing we're a little more comfortable with, our doctors. And I think most of the survivors here have like Japanese American doctors that they feel comfortable, you know, more or less comfortable with. But, you know, that's something that, that's interesting. But I don't think it's that large a problem with this, the group here, you know, as on the mainland.
It's interesting.
But still, you know, they, I think the fact that they can talk to someone who speaks Japanese, that that's an important part of the consultations. So,
Do you think it's the difference from mainland and survivors feeling in mainland of how this may not be a welcome subject to bring up with their doctors? Do you think that that's mostly because Japanese Americans or Japanese in total are more or less majority, or at least not minority in Hawaii? Or is this because probably the race consciousness or the environment revolving around the issues of race is probably different in Hawaii?
I know, I can't really answer that because I don't know what it's like to be on the mainland, you know. And
but just based on your impression,
guess my impression is that if you're, and I guess I have to look at it like this, because when I go to the mainland, I don't feel Japanese. I mean, like I'm, you know, different from everyone else. Mm-hmm. The sense I get when I talk to kind of some people, the mainland, or what I read, what I read about the mainland Japanese Americans or Asian Americans is they see themselves as a different group outside of your larger American population.
Right.
There's a very definite identification as an Asian American or Japanese American or Chinese, you know, Korean American.
Mm-hmm.
And here, although we tend to ask people and identify people by their ethnic background,
mm-hmm.
I don't think it's so much as trying to identify as a minority group, but mm-hmm. it's just, you know, I don't know, it's just something I always ask, you know, because I'm just curious, you know, kind of what people's backgrounds are.
Mm-hmm.
And because here you've grown up, I think as a Japanese American, you grow up with a lot of people who are kind of quote like you, and you don't see yourself as different from the Caucasians, you know, or the other group. Although you identify, you know, them, and you have Caucasians, you have Portuguese, you have all these ethnic groups, but you don't really see yourself as really my minority among them.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's because we're not such a small minority, because
right.
here we're a much larger group.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's part of my skewed way of looking at things is I don't feel like I'm part of a minority.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't identify myself as part of a minority.
Yeah.
Mm. And so, you know, like here you're just comfortable with anyone you meet and you can see, but on the mainland, it's like some people have, you know, if they're dealing with a Caucasian, it's like that's a real, it's something for them to think about. But
yeah.
Here, it's like it's just someone else, unless that person tends to be just a little off the wall, you know, rude person. But then you know, it's not any different.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think here too with some of the survivors, I think there's just within the context of the environment they're in, they don't see themselves as a Japanese American, as being in a minority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so on the mainland, that's
different.
Maybe that's different. And
more boundaries.
You know, always being kind of seen as different from the larger population.
Right. And there is an obvious history that sort of justifies that kind of feeling because of during World War II.
And you know, I was thinking too, because when we were in Chicago one time, this was like 20 years ago, we went to a Ghanaian festival in Chicago. And there were all these Ghanaians, and they were, you know, just to be in that environment and see just the whole festival. And also it's kind of when you look at or you read about like blacks who are from another country or an African coming to America and then how they kind of their relationship or how they behave in America is very different from a black growing up in America with all the discrimination and prejudice.
Uh-huh.
They are so much more confident.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, you know, being born here in Hawaii like that, if you're like Japanese American, that's kind of how you are because that's the way you are. You're confident in who you are.
Uh-huh.
So when you go to the mainland, it's just like you just act like you would act here, which
right.
is, you know, not worry about how the the other people will look at.
Much
you. Or you don't see yourself as a Japanese American on the mainland, you know, separate from that group.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's making sense.
Oh no, it does. It makes perfect sense to me. But I
that's my perspective. And
sure.
So when I look at our survivors, I kind of see them in that perspective too.
Yeah. It makes perfect sense to me. Maybe you can tell me a little more about your involvement in this nuclearly independent Pacific movement. How did you get interested in that? And maybe you had political, personal reasons why you wanted to be part of that.
It was, I guess, it's, I haven't thought about that in a long while. And I'm trying to think how I'm going to answer such a question if you ask something like that. And I was like, oh, that's hard. It came out of, in the 70s, it was the whole anti-nuclear thing. Starting with the Three Mile Island kind of thing, and that bringing up the Hiroshima Nagasaki bombings. And then following that, there were the A-bomb tests in the South Pacific in the Marshall Islands. And just looking, I guess, from the concern about how, radiation affects people,
mm-hmm.
And the long-term effects of
mm-hmm.
it, just it just was a something that was a concern, and not wanting people to be exposed to radiation when we really don't need to have that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess at that time the risk of nuclear warfare or nuclear radiation kind of
mm-hmm.
being populations being exposed to it, I think, was much higher than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And then just kind of learning about the Marshallese who were affected by the radiation, and then having to leave their islands, and then
right.
the contamination of the islands.
Mm-hmm.
That to me was just, it's seemed just incredible that our government would do something like that,
mm-hmm.
and then reading about for the Marshallese how they were affected by the radiation, which was very different from the kind of reading about the Hiroshima Nagasaki ones, because they're I didn't get into the reading a lot about the effects of radiation. I know I did a lot of reading about the Hiroshima and Nagasaki ones, trying to kind of understand more what was happening there.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't real deep, any kind of deep research on my part. And so it's just kind of out of a interest in people being able to live without the fear of being ill or dying from radiation, and
mm-hmm.
learning about how these things occurred. It was just what little we can do, we
mm-hmm.
need to raise the question about the effects of radiation on people and
mm-hmm.
on the environment.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any friends or group of people with whom that you talked a lot about those issues?
Well,
or somebody probably who introduced you to, there is this meeting over here, so let's go together.
Well,
like
it was
that.
Kind of, with my husband working with the American Friends Committee,
Service
and just kind of, going to meetings with him and being part of the AFSC,
mm-hmm.
Kind of my involvement there, not deep involvement, but involvement
mm-hmm.
there, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, just kind of through that.
Mm. I, as a historian, find it very interesting that 1960s and 70s and well into the 80s, there is a lot of involvement on the part of American minorities in those social activism,
mm-hmm.
or political activism. And if you think about it, you know, Asian American movement that try to bring together Asian minorities, Koreans, Chinese, Japanese, Filipinos, and later on
mm-hmm.
Vietnamese as well, together so that they could sort of, you know, fix the injustice that's
mm-hmm.
being done
mm-hmm.
against
mm-hmm.
the minorities. And, you know, that's how the Red Dress movement started to
mm-hmm.
pick up its
mm-hmm.
speed as well.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that those, you know, other types of political activism or raising awareness on those issues might have had some relationship to your interest in this?
No, I don't think my race had anything to do with it, or my Japanese background. It was more just the, I think my... Not being Japanese American. I don't think that had anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm. I guess no.
It was just not wanting more nuclear capability and
mm-hmm.
just, you know, the interest in letting people know about. What happens when we have, nuclear
mm-hmm.
nuclear tests? I mean,
yeah.
there are consequences, and very drastic consequences.
Right.
And even to think about, just for national security. I mean, you have to really think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I understand when you say that personally you don't see the
mm-hmm.
race
mm-hmm.
having anything to do with your other aspect of your activism. I just was noticing, however, that you earlier told me that you met with this person from mainland, Nancy Tarasaki.
I think Terasaki.
Terasaki.
Yeah.
Is she a Japanese American?
She's Japanese American.
Right.
And she was born and raised on, the West Coast, Los Angeles probably. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I talk to people in Friends of Hibakusha
mm-hmm.
as well, and they are oftentimes, they are not survivors themselves, so they don't really have a family connection
mm-hmm.
to survivors, but it looks like they are interested in survivors' status in America because they are kind of becoming aware of how Asian Americans in general are not treated well
mm-hmm.
in society.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder if you experience
mm-hmm.
anything like that.
Not here.
Not in Hawaii.
Yeah, in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And it was like, we have the survivors here. My thinking was, we have survivors here, and if there's anything out there that they can take advantage of in terms of their health or, their health, then, we should pursue that and
mm-hmm.
see what we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that's basically how I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Not so much as they're a minority and they need, they're because of that, they tend to get overlooked.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that, for example, they were these biennial visits by the Hiroshima government.
Right.
And I was like, oh, okay. And I don't think our survivors knew that. So
mm-hmm.
it's like
mm-hmm.
Making them aware of that. Also, and I'm not sure when in Japan the laws went into place about providing some payment for
mm-hmm.
medical exams or, for the survivors. But getting that information to the people or letting them know that
mm-hmm.
this was possible if they went to Japan, they
right.
could do that. So
right.
that's been kind of the motivation.
Right,
yeah.
I mean, I clearly
yeah.
see that. That's a more really immediate
yeah.
benefit
mm-hmm.
that you don't want to miss the
mm-hmm.
information about. How about presence of both men and women in this sort of group of people who tried to work and help out American mm-hmm. survivors. I ask you this because obviously the number of survivors, there's more women among survivors mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and compared to men, it's larger. But also I'm noticing how, you know, some key leadership roles are being played by women, mm-hmm. both among survivors and among people who want to work with them and mm-hmm. help them out.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really am impressed by it.
Huh.
Have you, I mean, do you think that in your work, do you think that, you know, you being a woman, being a man, mattered in any way?
No, I don't see it in terms of the gender thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see it. I'm thinking of like the non-survivors. I mean, I don't know very many. I'm not very good with outreach and networking. So, the people who I've worked with, it's been a woman, but there have been men. I mean, it's not been, you know, in terms of the non-survivors, it has been necessarily all women.
Oh no, yeah. Absolutely, there are male leaders
as well.
or more
women than
right,
men.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
I mean, with what I work with, it's not been one gender more than another gender.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I just was finding it very interesting that oftentimes the president of survivors organizations are male, and it kind of fits right into Japanese cultural tradition. But then if you, actually I went to 2 years ago, the medical checkup uh-huh. by Hiroshima doctors in San Francisco. And once I was on the site of the medical checkup, it's clear that women are those doing the job
mm-hmm.
of doing the, you know,
mm-hmm.
check-in and
right.
then they'll serve some meals or snacks
mm-hmm.
and then
they will
show
it's the same
away.
Thing true with here. It's like, well, there are more women in the group anyway.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, within, like, when we do the registration,
mm-hmm.
the survivor volunteers who do our registration, they're all women.
Why do you think that's the case?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
Mm.
I don't know. Most of the men this is kind of before. The group is really aging now.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been the younger survivors who have come to, you know, do the volunteering. We don't have younger male survivors.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the males are, you know, like in their 70s, whereas our volunteers, the survivor volunteers, they were born in like 1940 to 1945, so
mm-hmm.
they tend to be younger. And
mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that because they're younger and they're more comfortable, you know, doing the kind of sitting down at a desk and doing the registration and the paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
I just assume it was part of the age of the person
mm-hmm.
and their how comfortable they were kind of doing this kind of volunteer work.
When you say comfortable, what's involved in that sense of comfort?
Comfort, I guess, being able to interesting. I use that you asked me about being comfortable. I guess it's comfortable being, there to. Because when you register someone, you need to, take down some information or make sure they brought these things with them, and
mm-hmm.
then explain how this is before the format changed, but explaining, you know, like what to do, how to do things, what, you know, do they have all these forms that they were supposed to fill out and bring with them.
Right, right.
And I think it, you know, it, not everyone is comfortable doing that because it's being a little, you know, you have to kind of put yourself out there and ask people to do things. And some of us are, you know, we don't want to do that. So that's what I meant by comfortable.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And
kind of in public, I guess. You have to interact with people. You have to interact with
people
that
you, people you don't know, you know. And,
Yeah, that's very interesting.
And then, you know, some people don't like to talk to other people because they may feel that they can't explain or they can't say it properly or whatever. And even if you try to reassure them, no, it'll be okay. They still say, no.
Yeah.
They prefer not to.
So why are there many younger women survivors, whereas there aren't many younger male survivors?
I don't know. Yeah. I haven't looked at our, you know, data, but I was looking at... like Mrs. Kusana, who, you know, she always helps with our registration. She was born in, well, she was only a baby. She was born in 1945. But she, you know, she's very happy to come and help. And, and she's playing a bigger role this year because Mr. Hirano is not very well this, and not feeling very well. His health is not well this year. So,
So is Kusano-san, was she born here in Hawaii, or?
I don't know. See, I don't have her history.
Right.
She's one of those I need to talk to. And she's told me, you know, like even this year, because she has, she's become, quote, the contact person for the survivor side. And she said, you know, I guess she's, because her name has been out there on like the press release, she says she has calls, and she says, you know, I can't talk about my experience because I was only a baby at that time. And I said, no, I know, but you know, you explain that to them. You tell them, you know, you just talk about what you know, what you've heard, and what, you know, and just tell your side, and then the other, you know, whoever's talking to you, the reporter, can decide what to do with it.
Yeah,
you know? And that's all she can do.
Of course, you can't change that.
So, I haven't talked to her.
Right.
I need to do that. I do.
Yeah.
I really do need to talk to her. Even, like I said, it's like I haven't talked to a lot of these new people that I didn't meet. You know, I haven't met since like 1985. And I'll tell you why that. In 1982 or 83, definitely in 83, like you, I felt there was a need. There were these stories of these people that other people are not hearing and haven't heard, and their stories need to be told, and we need to, it's important to record their stories. So, with the help of several people, Dr. Franklin Odo, he used to be at the Ethnic Studies program at UH, this is like 1970s, and then he went to the Smithsonian. I don't know what he's doing now. But anyway, working with him, we got a grant from the Hawaii Community, Committee for the Humanities to do an oral history project. So we interviewed about 30 survivors. 30 survivors agreed.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I'll show you my my transcripts of the interviews.
I would love to look at that. Yeah.
And so we interviewed them, and some of them were willing to tell their names.
Mm-hmm.
Others were not, so we just used their initials. Some of them, and some of the conversation, the interviews were done in Japanese. I don't speak Japanese, but one of the other person who, two other people who Franklin knew and kind of got help to work on our project, they spoke Japanese, so they conducted some of the interviews in Japanese, and then we translated that to English. I forgot kind of what my point was, but...
So need to tell the story and preserve it. What happened to those interviews? Was it...
Well, my goal was to put them into a book.
Right.
But I kind of got... stymied by what needed to be done to get it into that form, and then kind of just didn't do it. And I need to do it, even if it's just to put it into one volume that you know I can preserve. But so I have the transcripts.
And they are all translated into English.
Into English. I don't think the tapes are any good, but we did, you know, tape record them.
Right.
That was another kind of stumbling block, because to edit the tapes, especially where the survivors didn't want certain information to go out because they reviewed the transcripts, you know, that was another big stumbling block that I did not have the means of overcoming.
It's a good practice, but it takes a lot of time and resources.
Which, you know, I didn't have. So, and then as part of the grant, we put together a slideshow and took the slideshow to Kauai, because there were Kauai survivors. To the major islands, Kauai, Maui, and the Big Island. Did we do one here? I can't remember. Anyway, Oahu, so I think just those three. And we presented the slideshow. And I can show you the transcripts for that too. The storyboard for that.
But didn't you donate it to the library or any archives?
No. It's and again, sorry.
I love to know.
No. And at this point in time it's like, something needs to be done. Yeah, and I guess you're contacting me and telling me about what you were doing, kind of like, okay, I know I need to do this. But it's like, okay, how do I do it, and what's the best way to do it?
We can certainly talk about that. Maybe I can give you some information about how I'm doing. It may not be appropriate or best way for you, but I think we can certainly talk
and
about that.
And also, there's an oral history project. Warren Nishimoto, I don't know if you know him.
Warren Nishimoto?
Yeah, I don't know if he's with the university. I don't know if he's retired by now, it was through him that I kind of, you know, learned about how to do the oral history thing. And I was going to contact him about, I did contact him initially about, what do I need to do to get this into a, you know, put it into a book form or something. But, you know, at least a bound form. And but I think I need a little more hand-holding and told, you know.
That's right.
A little bit more information. Anyway, it's like, I know I need to do it, but...
But that's a wonderful project that you worked on. What year did you?
That was in 1983.
Yeah.
So, you know, we did kind of, we did have the slideshow and shared some of the stories through the slideshow. And then, and I'm not sure when we ended this, but because it's a lot of work. And as I say, my network is... and I'm not very good at networking. But, you know, August would come about, and we had these really nice, large, poster-size photos of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and, you know, the destruction and pictures of people, you know, very well-publicized. And we would do, where we could find a venue, like at the YWCA, or at the library, you know, put up a photo exhibit of Hiroshima Nagasaki. That was about it. And after a while, it's kind of like, The stories come out, but then that's it. You know, around August, the stories come out, and that's it. And I guess my life went, you know, whatever, my life went on. But I, you know, eventually what it came down to was my energies just ended up focused on every 2 years when the doctors came from Japan to make sure that that happened smoothly and efficiently, and made sure that as many of our survivors who wanted to participate in it, you know, did so, and we could, you know, manage that. So it's kind of, that's how my involvement is at this point.
And, tell me a little more specifically then about exactly what you do to organize this medical visit, and if there's anything else that you do. I like to know, you know, what you do on the ground level, kind of.
Okay. Well, this year is a little different. In the past, I'll kind of give you an idea of in the past, and what it is in around March of every odd year, because 81, then 83, so every 2 years around March or January, if at the earliest, Mr. Hirano would call me and let me know that, oh, okay, that we're having the exams this year, and approximately when. And so the Hiroshima Prefectural Medical Association, and I don't know, you can tell me whether this is the way Japanese work, because it's the sense that this is how they work, that they have to work through this kind of hierarchy or protocol where they have to deal with the head person. So anyway, everything kind of goes to Mr. Hirano, then comes to me, and then... so I would, based on, you know, the information Mr. Hirano gave me, I would then make my contacts with, at this point, Kuakini Medical Center, because I guess since 1985 we've been working with Kuakini. They've been very generous in providing the space and kind of their support for the program. So because the way that the exams were done from like 85 to 2011 have been pretty much the same. You know, it would, my role would be to make my contact with Kuakini and make sure they knew when the medical exams are being held, because I didn't know what communication the Japanese side was doing with the Hawaii side, because I never got any of the correspondence.
And so Hirano does that, and then it kind of gets delegated to you.
See, up until about 4 years ago, Dr. George Suzuki was involved with the medical exam. He has since died. He was he did some work in the early 50s at the formerly at the ABCC. And so when they needed a physician here in Hawaii to kind of supervise the Japanese doctors when they were here. Because that's the way it was done on the mainland in Los Angeles. He, they asked him, because I think they had his, they knew about him through ABCC. So he was kind of the medical contact person here for the medical exam. So working with him and kind of, you know, touching bases with him, and then making sure that everything was kind of coordinated so that what he knew or what he was doing, I knew about. So when I was, when I contacted Kuakini, you know, we would all be on the same page. So it's kind of being the contact with whoever was trying, who was involved at this point. And then with Kuakini, it was letting them know when it was being held, and then and then making arrangements for or going over with them at that time, you know, the lab tests that needed to be done, and you know, they're providing the technicians for the various tests, reserving the space that we're going to use.
Right.
And at that time, when the samples, blood samples, were being sent back to Japan for analysis, working with the lab, and Mr. Hiran and I would be doing this, working with the lab to make sure that, you know, the specimens were going to be frozen, and then preparing them for the shipment back to Japan.
Right, and Mr.
Hirano did most of that.
Uh-huh.
But it's just kind of making those contacts to work out those little details. And then, you know, things like what the kind of supplies that were needed for the EKG, for the gynecological exams, for the stool samples and all that. And
of
then,
course.
You know, anyways, there's a whole list of things I would go over with my contact at Kuwakini. And just kind of making sure that those things were there and set up, and, you know, ready when the doctors came. And then also setting up courtesy visits with the Japanese consulate, and then the Hawaii Medical Association, kind of make. Well, Mr. Hirama dealt with the consulate because he could speak Japanese.
I see.
And I would deal with the Hawaii Medical Association, setting up the courtesy visits there. And then, you know, a long time ago, initially when the Hiroshima team came, you know, because it was at that time it was new to Hawaii, you know, we would set up courtesy visits with the mayor and maybe with the governor's office or the lieutenant governor's office. But then I felt that, you know, I felt they weren't that interested. It was like just another visit for them. So we just kind of stopped that and just did it with the consulate and the HMA.
Medical Association. Yeah.
And then like press releases, I would send out press releases because it was through the press releases that we came in contact with new survivors. And at one point, we were like over 200 that we had identified.
Right. Nowadays, it's down
to like 150.
150.
And in this last, in our last mail out announcing this year's exams, I got like 18 mailings returned to me because of unknown addresses, which is extraordinary because we've never received that many returned, and you know we're down to like 50, maybe about 55 survivors participating this year. Where in the past we've had like 70 to 80.
Right.
And I know that a number of the survivors are elderly and frail, and because of that, I'm thinking they didn't respond because a lot of the ones that I thought would be coming back, they haven't responded. And I know that a number of them, not a number of us, a few of them were exhibiting dementia, early dementia, 2 years ago.
I see.
So by now I'm thinking for some of them that's kind of, you know, it might be that they're just too frail. And some of them, a couple of them are in nursing homes. They were here 2 years ago. They participated 2 years ago, but then they're in nursing homes now. So the population is much, much more fragile.
Right. Well, you know, just listening to your description of your responsibilities in this work, it sounds like a lot for you. I mean, I'm sure you spend a lot of time dealing with mailing and communication.
Well, that's, it's like from, well, you know, it's over a period of time.
Right.
But this year, it's a little more, it's different. And see, this year, what they did. And I didn't find out until April. And I should have called Mr. Hirano earlier, but it was like, oh, this is April and I haven't heard anything yet, you know. And so this year it seems like everything kind of is kind of, you know, just compressed together. But this year they changed the format so that all the lab tests are being done prior to the consultations. And they included chest x-rays this year. So it's having, you know, and this year Mr. Hirano, because of his caregiving for his wife and then his own kind of health, you know, I told him I'll take care of everything. It's been kind of my contact with the Hiroshima Prefectural Medical Association, just setting with Kuwakini, setting up how to do the blood tests, how to do the chest X-ray, and how to, you know, scheduling all that. That's been a little different and a little more complicated and a little. You know, you have to kind of go through it once in order to find out where the problems are. So the next time you do it, you'll know, you know, how to, what needs to be done so you don't make things a little, you know, make things go a little smoother and less confusing. And that's been kind of a little frustrating because it's, sometimes it takes a while for information to come back and then, okay, we got to do this. Like now we just found out. Some of the survivors didn't get their one blood analysis done because they had been left out. So it was like, okay, having to send them a letter out, trying to explain, you know, what needed to be done, and getting them back. So,
so do you think that they can get it done before the team of the doctors arrive?
We have about 10 days, but okay. And because it's going to be, you know, all of this is voluntary. So
right.
I checked with our contact at Kuwakini and said, if, you know, do they have to do it? Because I need to put in the letter. You know, the answer was, no, since this is voluntary and since this is kind of recorded a little late, if they don't want to do it, you know, they won't have to do it. You know, next time, when we do it next time, it'll be part of the whole lab analysis, so we'll pick it up again.
What do you think you take away from your work? It's all volunteer and it's a lot of work. What value do you see? I mean, of course, there are obvious things, but I'm really curious to know what you think.
I think the value is that here's a group of people who, if this doesn't get done, you know, that sounds very egotistical, but and I guess here's a group of people who value this kind of effort by the Japanese government and who benefit from it and who need it, and so. You know, if there's any way to facilitate that, then of course, you know, and it's, and what I'm doing, it's time, really, it's time. Because a lot of the expenses, I get reimbursed for it, so it's, you know, it's just time. And I guess part of it is, it's something I can do, that I know I can do, and I can, you know, it gets done. So, that's fine. If I can do it and, you know, it's something I can do, then I'll do it. But if it's something I can't do, then, you know, I wouldn't do it.
So expenses reimbursed by whom?
Gets reimbursed by the survivors group.
Survivors group.
Yeah.
Okay.
They'll reimburse for all the you know, copying and the travel, you know, what, well, in Honolulu when I have to travel there.
Of course. How do you feel about the value that the Hawaiian Medical Association sees in this project?
You know, that's an interesting, I mean, the Hawaii Medical Association, I'm going to tell you something that, can we turn the tape recorder off here?
Okay, well, what I can do is, I like to know for later, for my own knowledge, what you're going to tell me, but I can eliminate that from the part the, that
from
would
the transcript,
go into.
Right.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
Okay, I'm going to take your word
I'm
on
gonna
this.
I'm going to take a right. And it kind of guide us to my next question, which is, why do you think is the status of all of this program, medical exams, being paid and supported and conducted by Japanese government and Japanese physicians? Because I know, especially on the mainland, in 1970s and well into the early 80s, survivors group really wanted to get attention of the U.S. government to pay for their healthcare needs and try to use even the part of Medi-Cal to support their particular needs. And then they were American-born American citizens, many of them anyway. Do you think that there should be a balance around that issue, or do you think that, you know, having Japanese doctors, despite the legal difficulties that they might encounter both here in Hawaii and the mainland and all that, it is a good idea to do it in that way, being supported entirely by the Japanese side?
I've never really thought of that. And that brings up a question, well, that's related to, see, next year, I don't know. I can't answer that question. I don't feel I can answer that question. And next year, the Hiroshima, although it hasn't been officially, they haven't heard officially from the Japanese government, but the prefectural medical association feels that they will get the funding to just provide exams without doctor consultations next year for the survivors who have TCHOs. And the question becomes, and the question is like, do we need that for the survivors? You know, they've had every 2 years, and do we need to have an exam? Do we need to have them examined, have those tests every year? And I think, and I'm partly, the question becomes here. Most of our, if you're 65 or older, you can get covered under Medicare,
right?
And there may be some tests that are not covered by Medicare or secondarily by, you know, your health insurance. But the question becomes, what's the purpose of the lab tests without the consultation? If it's just to kind of, quote, screen, then, you know, if our... All of our survivors, you know, would be covered under Medicare. So, I don't know. You know, from the Japanese side, I don't, you know, for next year's exam, I don't know. You know, is that worth it? I don't know.
So, are you saying then, if most of the survivors are going to be covered by Medicare, which is based on American tax money? Which you can see as a support by the U.S. government, if it's going to be a real question.
I wouldn't see it as a quote support, but
they're
covered.
Yeah.
It's a different kind. It's a different thing. So, but I mean, it's a question that when the team comes in July, I want to raise with the group. I know the results will be shared with the survivors and their primary doctors, the personal doctors, yeah. I guess my question is, you know, for the on the Japanese side, you know, what is the purpose here? And there's also a question of how much longer can we have these biennial visits by the Hiroshima team coming to the United States when our population is, you know, close to 80 years old. And I'm looking at the numbers just in Hawaii in terms of look at how much we who participated in 2 years ago and now, and you know, just a decline in the number of people and their health. At what point, you know, does it become, does it become really not costly, but beneficial?
I was often wondering about that as well. Not necessarily because I don't see the benefit of continuing this medical checkup, but because some of the survivors I talk to, they go to see Hiroshima doctors and they are happy to see them. But on the other hand, many of them at the same time also told me that, you know, they are doing research for their own purposes. They have a reason to want to come here. Do you see anything like that during the exams, or do you see anything like the benefit that medical doctors may be getting out of it by being part of this project? And I'm not saying that this is a bad thing necessarily. I think it's just the nature of what...
See, that's interesting because, I mean, I have been working under the assumption that this was, quote, a humanitarian effort on the part of the Japanese side.
Right.
And you know, I've been told that this is a research project, you know. And I know that RERF is involved in the project, but because when I read the report from, you know, from the 2009 one, because I haven't gotten the 2011 one yet. It seems like our population, the numbers are too small to draw any kind of significant connections between exposure and any diseases. And, you know, they are kind of chronicling or noting various kind of diseases that are related to, you know, aging, the obesity, the high blood pressure, and cardiovascular disease. But I guess I haven't seen, I don't see it as a research thing. I that's not the sense I'm getting. I don't know. It's just my lack of not digging and not, you know, not wanting to dig. But
yeah, I guess, you know, some number is very small, but also at the same time, this is a very unique group of survivors, and there aren't too many survivors around the world.
And they do, and you know, when you think about it, you know, they do have data that go back to, like, well, for Hawaii, 1981, and, you know, they can track the people who have been coming all that time. But... I don't know. I don't know. That's a good question, and I think I will ask someone when the person from the RERF, he's part of the team, how they see the U.S. data in, you know, in relation to the data in Japan, because I know RAF has several long-term studies of the survivors.
And that's but, much needed kind of medical research. Again, I'm not suggesting that was that would be bad if there is any research interested in it. I would be surprised if there is none. But I just wondered from where you stand, if you saw anything that's mixed into this sort of humanitarian project.
Because, you know, and when I look at the list of doctors who are coming, and you know, a number of them are with the medical school at Hiroshima University. Maybe there's one with RERF, but I don't get the sense that the medical doctors, this is a research thing for them. Because one is, it changes almost every 2 years.
Right,
And I don't, and I, I don't know. I don't get the sense for those doctors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I was told that, you know, sometimes young and up-and-coming doctors in Japan are given this opportunity to come visit America.
Uh-huh.
And it's a hard work for them. It takes a lot of energy and time on their part. But also it's kind of like going to America and then you get to have this credential on your resume, kind of. And again, this is not something I hear from everybody, but some people mention that. So that was kind of unexpected for me to hear this aspect of the visit.
No, I didn't know that. See, part of my problem is a lot of times the doctors have very limited English. And so it's, for me, it's, you know, to converse with them is difficult because I don't speak Japanese.
So you just focus on the most crucial information and try to get it through.
And if I do try to converse, they're frustrated because their English is limited. Mm-hmm. I'm frustrated because I can't speak to them in Japanese and I can you know, ask them in Japanese. So, you know, it's like, okay, then. So, but it's not something I pursued.
Mm-hmm. No, that's fine. I just was curious.
Yeah.
Now, my next question is from a slightly different angle.
Mm-hmm.
So you told me earlier that you taught for a while, or you were a school teacher for a while.
Oh, yeah. I was taught what's called middle school.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, 7th, 8th grade. Seven and 8th grade.
Uh-huh. Did you teach your student or just talked about your experience of working with U.S. survivors in any classroom environment?
No, I didn't. And I'm trying to think. I taught science, physical science, but I kept to the curriculum. And we're taught math, a little bit math, but then so I didn't find an opportunity to do that.
It wasn't like a social studies, I guess, or history for that matter.
It wasn't social studies or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's kind of like work was working. This was something else.
Something else.
Yeah.
I understand, I think. Did you do other volunteer work than the one for the survivors?
You mean like in... with a lot of work? It was related to my work, so because I was involved with the middle school association, so kind of did, and it was volunteer work because it was outside of school and outside of school time.
Right.
So, kind of my volunteer work with the middle school association here in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that. Not real sustained volunteer work. Mm.
So this is really long term.
This is my own. Yeah, my only project that I've been involved in for this long a time.
It's a more than 30 years of project for you. Does it? I mean, it's a funny question in a way, but does it make sense to you, given what you know about yourself, the kind of person that you are, do you kind of sit back and look at this long-term project that you volunteer so much of your time and energy for and think that, oh, this looks like what I'll be doing?
No. You know, well, it's hard. I mean, I think back then I don't think I was looking this far forward ahead. I knew back then that... whatever the decision I made to be involved with the group, had to be a long-term decision.
Mm.
And I don't, and long-term at that time was, I don't, you know, I had no idea what long. It right. had to be more than 1 year.
Right, right.
And it was like something, it's not something I could just be involved with and then not be involved with. So it was, I went into it knowing that I would have to commit myself to mm-hmm. being, doing this for more than one, at least 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
But then, and part of being involved, you know, all this time is that over the years, it doesn't seem like it's a job, you know, or mm. it doesn't seem like work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Having, you know, you deal with people and they've been very, very nice people to deal with, and you mm. meet, you know, you're in a really good people,
mm-hmm.
you know, on the medical teams mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, working with like various you know, Kuakini group. It's just, it's been a very enjoyable, easy working relationship, and I mm-hmm. think that makes it easy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's like, okay, we go through it this time and we get it done, and you know, it works out, and
mm.
And so it's, you know, it's like everybody pitches in and helps, mm-hmm. which, when you think about it, that makes it worthwhile.
Mm.
You know, or, okay, next year, no, it's not going to be a big deal. It's not going to be a big deal. You know?
Yeah.
So but I know that at some point, you know, when you ask, like we have a group of, I work with someone who, she knows retired nurses. So that's mm-hmm. where we get some of our volunteers to help, you know. Well, when we had, we needed people in the exam rooms to come mm-hmm. help.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's like at some point and she's been doing this like for almost as long as I have.
Ah, okay.
So.
What is her name, if I may ask?
Her name is Nancy Kim. She's Nancy a retired Kim. Nurse.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like at some point I don't feel I can continually ask for that kind of help.
Mm.
You know, 'cause and I tell her, you know, and she says, oh, no, you know, some of the ladies, you know, they enjoy it, so they come out and help.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But they're, you know, they're getting older also.
Right, and, right, yeah.
And I'm getting older also, so.
Everybody does.
Yeah,
yeah.
So, you know, kind of, one wonders, you know, you wonder about how long can we sustain this.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Now, do you see mostly Japanese-American volunteers to help out this biennial checkup, or do you see diversity?
Oh, diverse group, yeah. And it's not just, I mean, you tend to see more Japanese Americans because they just tend to be more of them. I don't know. It's not particular because it's Japanese American.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, we have volunteers from, you know, other than the Japanese.
Could you please give me specific examples, like their backgrounds and their interest maybe in this project?
Well, I think these are just people giving people, because, you know, I think they would volunteer to help for other things.
Uh-huh.
Majority of them are, I'm thinking now, majority are Japanese, so Japanese Americans, but, you know, we've had... oh God, non-Japanese. I can't remember what ethnic group they're from, but you know, they've come in to help. And
mm-hmm. well, Nancy Kim sounds like a Korean name to me.
Yeah, but yeah. I don't know what her ethnicity is. Her, you know, she. I think her husband may be Korean, but
I see
was Korean, but I don't think Nancy's Korean.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think she's Japanese, but
okay,
her husband is. I think. Was Korean.
So she adopted her husband's name
when they married.
Yeah, right, right, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, well, you know, like one of, well, we had Judith Ramsey. She was a doctor. And she would come and she would volunteer every time we've had. And she passed away about 3 years ago. But, you know, she helped.
She's a Caucasian?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. She's
okay.
Caucasian, and she would always help. And, let's see. Yeah, because some of the nurses who came to help were non-Japanese, but I can't specifically. They're Portuguese or yeah. Anyway, they're non-Japanese, but I can't pinpoint their ethnicity because it was like
you don't necessarily focus.
It was
on that.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like, oh, thank you for coming. You
know? Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
That's the most important part of it.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So
yeah. Do you see anything that you hope to be improved in terms of what survivors here are able to have an access to, in terms of what they can have for their needs?
I don't know, because I don't know what their needs are. I don't, you know, that... And I'm thinking, I'm not really very good for your interviews, because I see them just for this short period of time, and it's like every 2 years, and I only see them for a particular thing or reason, and, you know, their outside lives, and if they have any health concerns, is something I am not aware of. I know that... we have one survivor who has had a particular disease or ailment, and I don't think it's... I'm not sure what caused it, but, you know... and I don't know if she's looking for some kind of... quote answers to help her understand what's happening, or, you know, how to treat what she has, and, you know, I don't know if the doctors coming to talk to the doctors helps, because I, you know, I feel like if I ask questions like that, I'm probing a little too much more than I need to. It's you know, something it's more, it's something more personal for them to discuss with the physician, and not something that, you know, for me to kind of find out about.
Right, right.
But I didn't, you know, I received a phone call from someone, the wife of, I think her husband is a second generation, but it was someone we had no contact with before. And he was in, the husband was in Hiroshima, is in Hiroshima. And so she wanted to kind of find out about the exams here to see if they would be able to help diagnose the health problems her husband was having. And I told her that basically when the doctors here, they don't do diagnoses, you know, because they're not, I mean, they're not prepared to do that. They may point out things that are abnormal based on the test results, but they can't really make a diagnosis. And when she told me her husband was in Hiroshima, and so, you know, I told her that since it's Hiroshima, and there are clinics there that, you know, like, I don't know about them, but they would, if he went to one of the clinics there, or that would, that they may be able to help him more than these team of doctors here would, because you would have more expertise there than this small team coming here. So, you know, when you talk about needs, it's like, well, some people, I guess, they're looking for answers for some diseases that they have that, I guess, for causes that they haven't been able to find. But then... I don't know if this team of doctors are equipped to do that. I know that there's a program where, based on the results of the medical exams, because I think if based on what Mr. Hirano has told me, if someone is identified as maybe in need of further follow-up because mm-hmm. their results show something really abnormal, that there's a group in Hiroshima that will invite...
Right, right. Hirano-san once went to Hiroshima as well, I think, using that group, mm-hmm. The program.
And a number of our survivors have gone over.
Uh-huh,
so,
uh-huh.
you know, I guess there's that program. But from our side, I don't think I've heard any comments from the survivors when, you know, I see them like during the exams of mm-hmm. Wishing they had something more was done. When you think about it, there's not really much from the Japanese side that they can do. Mm. And as you said, a number of them go back to Japan,
right.
you know, periodically and
right.
kind of do get examined back there or checked up back there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah. So I don't know if there are any needs out there mm-hmm. at this point in time.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is so special about this damage that either the bomb or radiation can do to humans or human societies for you? Obviously, this is something that is the most important voluntary work that you have done in your adult life, it sounds like. And that there must be something really special or even scary maybe about that that really spoke to you.
You know, I haven't thought about it, and I think I really have to think about it to answer your question, and it's like I don't know. At this point in time, well, early on it was like, okay, we don't know what the effects of radiation was. And this is what, like 1980, this is like 40 years after the bomb. Mm-hmm. So it was like, it's still, you know, there was time for time for unknown connections mm-hmm. or causations or mm-hmm. correlation. I mean, causation. So at that time it was okay, you know, having the medical exams and the people, their concerns. It's the survivor's concern and their not knowing
mm-hmm.
what damage could happen.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that and finding and helping to alleviate that concern, I guess that's been important. That, whatever we're doing is helping them cope with whatever concerns they have and questions they have about mm-hmm. themselves or about their children. And I guess that's been the fact that, you know, one small thing that you can do is help in that way.
Mm.
And you feel like, okay, you know, and from what I've heard from the survivors, that's something that they find helpful.
Mm.
That's been very heartening,
mm-hmm.
that they find it helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And they appreciate having this opportunity to participate in these exams
mm-hmm.
That are being offered to them.
Right,
yeah.
right. So there's a sense of appreciation on
yeah,
the part
and
of
they appreciate,
yeah.
you know, they
yeah.
appreciate having the exams
mm-hmm.
yeah, coming. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the, expansion of the use of nuclear power, in terms of the use of nuclear power for military purposes?
Purposes? Definitely not,
mm-hmm.
Even on a small scale, I mean, look at what, it's like, it's not like using a conventional bomb. Mm-hmm. I mean, conventional bombs are horrific in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and you have the, on top of that, you have the long-term effects of the radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and, you know, what do you do about that? And just still the kind of not knowing how, what the effects are, you know, and how long term, and, you know, it's not visible.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
And I mean, and some of these bombs are like, I don't know that much of military things, but, you know, like some of these are, they're powerful, like the neutron bombs. I mean, it can penetrate more deeply and be more destructive than, you know, these the initial bombs, the Hiroshima Nagasaki bombs.
Absolutely.
You know? And I mean, the fact that some of these are just humongous in size, and, you know, you kind of wonder, you know, don't these people realize that if they detonate a bomb, the other side's gonna, you know, you're gonna attack them and you're gonna, you know, do whatever you do. But look at the additional damage, you know, in the physical damage, yes, but look at the other damage that
mm-hmm.
you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, think about like Chernobyl and then now the Fukushima, you know, and these whole areas just, you know, off limits. And
do you feel against the civilian use of the nuclear power?
I have my reservations about that,
mm-hmm.
because there's a whole question of the spent fuel,
mm-hmm.
you know. I think the question about the safety of the plants, you
mm-hmm.
know, I think people realize, not people, there's some people feel that they can be built safe.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the question of storage of the spent fuel, because
mm-hmm.
some of that is going to be, you know, a long time. And, yeah, you can put them underground, you can put them in the salt mines, but, you know, most of us are not going to be here when this, it's still down there. And what guarantee or what, you know, what assurance do we have that it's going, quote, whatever technology we have today,
mm-hmm.
in terms of containing all that, is going to be safe many years from now, many hundreds of thousands of years from now, when that some of that is still hot.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I'm thinking of Fukushima with all those huge water tanks for all that irradiated water they're having to store. And
yes.
it's like, at some point in time, you're not going to have space for that. What are you going to do with all that?
Right.
You know, what are you going to do with all the water that you have to decontaminate? You haven't decontaminated.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about Chernobyl, where they put all the soil and stuff, but, you know, it's, what are you going to do with all that
mm-hmm.
contaminated stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Some people are quite optimistic, and I guess I'm not one of those optimistic ones.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah.
Now, I've already asked you many questions, and it's been a while, but do you have anything that you like to probably elaborate on or add on to what you already told me? I'm limited. I can't ask all the possible questions. So I'd like you to tell me probably something that you like to make sure that I hear from you.
No, I really can't. No, talking to you and sometimes getting, you know, kind of calls, like responses to the press releases we put up about
mm-hmm.
the interest in like reporters talking to the survivors. I think you've kind of reminded me, and it's a good reminder of the importance of having these stories told, you know, the survivors telling their stories. Because at some point, I felt that, and I'm not sure why I got this feeling of people were a little tired, or, you know, if every year you continue to bring up the same stories, people kind of feel that, no, it's, you know, they don't want to hear it, or this has already been told, I already know about it. But I think, you know, sometimes I think about the Holocaust survivors, and there was, I'm not sure, there was, I can't remember. This is my old age coming in. The importance of reminding people about what happened, and that, and that these were just, you know, what happened to people at this time, and that we shouldn't forget that this has happened, and what these people had to go through. I think that I think has become important, and I kind of beginning to feel guilty that I have not been helping to do that.
But you put in so much work to help the stories be out.
Well, and, no, you know, I haven't. Not in the past few years. My work has been, I haven't done that, you know. My work is more concentrated on just kind of getting the exams and getting that.
But you also have had a profession of your own as a school teacher, then to create a time to work for this group of people is not without sacrifices.
I guess I don't see it as a sacrifice.
Of course,
I guess when you look at it from another point of view, it's like, well, you know, it's putting all this time into it. It's like, wow. And when I look back on it, it's like, wow, yeah, this was like 30 years ago. Oh, my God, has it been that long? You know, because it doesn't seem like it's been that long. And sometimes it's like when I have to call and get some volunteers, I go, hello, you know, it's that time of year again. Because it seems like we just finished it, you know. But I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, that's right, it's that time of year again. And, you know, it's like, you don't know for other people that you've called on to help in the past where they are at this point in time. The nation or the world, I tend to just think about Hawaii because this is my world right now. It's just the importance of making sure that the stories get out and the stories are told and the stories don't get lost. I think that's very important.
And I think that, you know, many cases, survivors coming together, even only once in 2 years, really help them to get their stories out because they have a chance to talk to each other.
And it's almost become like a big reunion, you know.
In
fact, that's what they say, you know, when they come and they're just happy to see each other. And sometimes this is the only time that they get to see some classmates, previous classmates, or just kind of come together and just talk. Those are just kind of things. And again, and it's for them, it's like, when you see that, you just feel like, oh, this is great. This is great that they can do this.
And you had a quite a bit of a role to play to make that happen. And people like yourself who helped that to continue on. I think that's very true that people come sometimes, you know, they hire a bus to come from a separate far away place to the site of the
I guess that's on the mainland, but for here
it's still a lot of traveling that they have to make time to come, but they come because they like to see other people who be there. And that's how I think stories really came out to be told. Mm-hmm. I do think that there is elements that help that to happen.
Mm-hmm. And one of the difficulties has been, I guess I've been reluctant to just call, well, I guess it's been based on my talking to when I was asking the survivors to be part of the Oral History Project is, you know, asked more than 60 or 70, and we only got half of them to consent. And I guess that experience made me a little wary about continually asking survivors to kind of, when interviews were being requested, you know, so I would call on people who I knew were, one, comfortable speaking in English, and that's another problem is when we have local journalists doing stories, you know, they only speak English, and so you're kind of limited to who you can ask. My experience with their reluctance to want to talk kind of made it a little more difficult, made it kind of made me a little hesitant about asking people. You didn't know who was going to say yes or no, and sometimes, like, you know, there's no one. And I think it's a matter of time.
And when people get older, they may not worry about losing health insurance. Again, an example from the mainland, but people did worry about getting their story out as a consequence, having to lose.
There are those stories about the mainland survivors, and I look at our survivors, and I think that hasn't, you know, those kinds of things didn't come up. Because I think, I'm not sure if, those, when I talked to the survivors, those were not their concerns, as the mainland. So it's very interesting, these two groups. They're very, very different in terms of how they see themselves in terms of, the healthcare and all this. Yeah. But, and there it was mainly how it might affect their insurance and other, you know, being identified. And here I think part of it is it's not being denied insurance, but I think more personal. Sometimes, you know, when you have something this personal and the curiosity that it might create in other people that becomes a little intrusive.
Because
I received a phone call, you know, from this, and I'd forgotten that this can happen, but when we did the press release this year, this young man called, and he wanted to know where the exams are being held, and he had talked to Mrs. Cusano, and she had, you know, she's very, you know, gave out the information, I had to call her and tell, because I had talked to him, I had to tell her, please don't tell them where it's being held. One, because Kuakini is not, I didn't want phone calls to Kuakini by people thinking that they were, I didn't want to bother them with the people calling to set up, you know, wanting information, because that's not their role. And plus, to some extent, I figure we need to screen who's calling, because we need to know whether they're legitimate or not.
Sure.
And so this young man calls, and, you know, he read about it, and he says, oh, wow, you know, A-bomb survivors living here, U.S. A-bomb survivors. So I didn't know we had this. You know, that's really interesting. And, you know, can I come by to the exams and, you know, see what's like? And I said, no, you can't. You know, this is not a show.
Right.
You can't.
Right.
You just can't come up and, you know, and I asked him what, you know, what was his interest in it.
So right.
I read about it and it was like, wow. So, I forget the one. So excited about that, I forgot my point here. But there is a curiosity that I think, you know, it's kind of like when you become a celebrity because of something that's happened to you,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and that yeah. becomes a little intrusive, and your privacy becomes, you know, is broken down. You know, you don't mm-hmm. have that privacy in mm-hmm. anymore. And I think
right.
For the survivors who don't want to, it's part of it. I think is that privacy, and mm-hmm. it's that privacy I want to respect,
sure,
and
yeah.
and protect. You know. And respect that privacy if they wish they want it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating in my experience that there are survivors for whom this is more than 100th time to talk to somebody like me or somebody mm-hmm. who's non-survivors but interested in their stories for whatever reasons. And then there are survivors who would be telling this story almost for the first mm-hmm. time, and they sometimes told me that they really didn't, you know, make time to sit down to talk about their experiences even to their own family members.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognize the variety of willingness or lack thereof mm-hmm. to talk about their experiences, and I think that's exactly where we have to be respectful mm-hmm. of. I mean, there will be a right time even mm-hmm. for a same person. Mm-hmm. Maybe if you ask now, it will be okay, but maybe 5 years
right.
ago, it wouldn't have been okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I think uh-huh. that's where this kind of interaction mm-hmm. relationship is mm-hmm. very important to mm-hmm. make sure that everybody is here because, you know, he or she wants to be here.
Right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and it happened like... This is when, in kind of the early 80s, when we would have, like, the news stations come over and do a short story about mm-hmm. the exams. And, you know, their feeling is, well, you know, they can just video, you know, the group. And I told them, you can't. You got to ask permission because...
Right.
You know, you just can't go in there and video them. You got to ask permission, you
yeah.
know? And it's like, I got upset with some of them because they just come in and they act as if it's like, this is a public event that they
yeah.
can just come in, talk to whomever they want, and photograph and video whoever they want without asking.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, you can't do that. Look, even if, come on, like, they want to go into the exam room and see what it's like.
That's privacy.
They're undressed. You can't do that.
We can
do it from the back. Okay, I'll ask, you know, and you find someone who's willing. But it's that kind of, I guess part of that kind of, when I guess I'm talking to you now, it's like, it's that kind of behavior that really kind of makes me want, you know, if someone's calling, then okay, you know, better screen it so
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
the privacy of these people are respected and, you know,
right.
taken into consideration.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I understand that it must have been quite a challenge for you to conduct as many as 30 interviews. I think, though, it's wonderful that you try to preserve their stories and memories. And
yeah.
then I'm sure if I were to have a chance to come back to those 30 same people today... their stories must be very different because their memories, their
yeah.
ways of talking about mm-hmm. their experiences change over time.
And in
time.
Fact, you know, this freelance journalist that I need to set up some interviews with, she had interviewed Mr. Hirano and Mrs. Motoyama
uh-huh.
2005, so that's what, like 8 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And when I read their stories and what I remember their stories from their oral histories, it's like different.
Yeah.
You know, so
interesting.
I need to go back now and kind of do a little more detailed kind of comparison. But yeah, it's, you know, it's different.
Mm.
And then I need to show you kind of, I'd like to show you my...
I'd love to see it. Would you actually have a scanner with me?
Do
you
think? I would not like to do that because...
Okay.
One is...
Okay.
This is something that really kind of struck me. No, I was I had a opportunity to go to Japan. I think it was in 1980s.
Uh huh.
And this was it must have been after 83, because I had been doing a lot of reading and looking at books relating to Hiroshima, Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the trip, I think we went by train to Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember. Yeah. And so from the train station to our hotel, we took a bus. And I remember we were coming and we were going over a bridge. And it was the weirdest feeling, because it was like, I was like, oh my God, this is what it was like.
Yeah.
From the pictures I saw. I mean, it was like almost being there, because, I was just kind of having looked at all the pictures. It was like, oh my God, it was just this weird feeling of being there in like 1945. It's like, oh, just weird.
Yeah. What year did you go to Hiroshima?
Sometime in the early 80s.
80s, okay. Yeah. So after you started to work for survivors, then you went to...
Let's see, was it after or... Yeah, probably 80... Maybe it was in 82, because in 80... No, it couldn't be in 82. Maybe in 84? Maybe in 84.
Did you go to the memorial museum?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I think, I'm not sure, I'm trying to remember. I think that Nagasaki one was the one that affected me more. I'm not sure. It's been so long. Anyway. But I mean, is that one feeling at that time was like, ooh.
Yes.
It gave me the chills. Yeah. It gave me the chills.
Yeah. I think please.
So these are my a termite. I need to get... So these are the stories. So this is Mrs. Aoki, which you mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's 84.
Okay.
It's later.
How long do you think that that each one of those interviews might have been? Was it like an hour long, or did it depend?
I think it depended on who we talked to.
Yeah.
And not all of these are like transcripts. A couple of maybe just kind of summaries of an interview, because some of the interviews were difficult to it didn't kind of flow like some of these did. So
right,
but. And yeah, I need to go back and look at these, because I haven't really looked and reread them
mm-hmm.
over the years.
This is such enormous amount of work that went into it, because I'm actually working on the transcribing and translating mm-hmm. of interviews that I've been conducting, mm-hmm. and there is another body of interviews that's conducted by this a person that covers the South American survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And there is another set of oral history records conducted by members of Friends of Hibakusha
mm-hmm.
back in 1980s and
mm-hmm.
early 90s. And I know that transcribing and translating is just such a huge block for creating anything like this. I think it's highly, highly valuable. I think you should... I mean, it's a great idea to try to put the book together, but I think even more important for you might be to consider, you know, finding an archive, historical archive,
mm.
to house those,
mm.
because there are, that's actually
mm-hmm.
exactly what I'm working on
mm-hmm.
right now, and they would love to have those, this kind of material.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you still want to publish it as a book, you can still do that.
It's not to publish it, but just to bind it.
Uh-huh.
Because at that time, when, you know, oral histories were being done, and it was like those were bound in, you know, book form,
mm-hmm.
and then copies were placed in different places. And I do want to, you know, I think our public libraries should, you know, at least have a copy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, there were obstacles that I at that time didn't want to.
I think you should think about going to bigger university libraries. University of California may be interested in that.
Oh.
I'm sure that actually even the Library of Congress would eventually be interested in that. The National Archive, I think.
That I never thought of beyond, you know, that. Yeah.
This is very valuable. Now tell me the reason why you don't want to have the copy.
I guess that's it's a selfish one. It's a proprietary one. It's the work that I put into it,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
letting it out right now. I'm not sure, you know, about that.
Okay.
So, yeah.
From where I stand, if I don't have a copy of this, there's nothing I can learn from it, because I need to sit down and take
mm-hmm.
a look, and I cannot do it in 30 minutes.
Right.
I cannot do
right.
it maybe over
right.
a course of 2 days.
Right. Right.
Sometimes I have used the actually what historians like myself use is oftentimes unpublished materials.
Mm-hmm.
I have used personal letters.
Mm-hmm.
I have used things that are not published out there, and people have a plan of
mm-hmm.
publishing it later. What I usually do is those materials that are privately owned by individuals is to make sure that I use the information included in that in a way that is agreeable
mm-hmm.
to the owner
mm-hmm.
of that. Oftentimes what it means is that I would credit it in a very
mm-hmm.
clear way
mm-hmm.
that this is
mm-hmm.
Because of the favor
mm-hmm.
and willingness of this person
mm-hmm.
who gave me access
mm-hmm.
to this, and your name, if you wish me to,
mm-hmm.
would be published as a part of the mm-hmm. note that would come with the use of mm-hmm. this material.
So let me think about that.
Okay. Okay.
And if not this time, you know, I can figure out a way to, but I need to think about that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But tell me a little more about your concerns. So you are saying that you put in so much work.
It's like my little baby.
Of course.
Yeah. And it's like, it's like, I even thought beyond it just being made available to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's not available to the public yet,
mm-hmm.
I guess that's part of my hesitation. I don't know the logic behind it,
mm-hmm.
but I'd have to think about it. So, yeah. And I can't give you any more reason than that.
Okay.
I mean, it's difficult to let go of something like mm-hmm. this. I'm, you know, beginning to realize it. Because it's, like you said, it was a lot of work, and
mm-hmm.
and I know the, you know, and this is why it's like after 30 years, and I'm like, come on, you know, this needs mm-hmm. to be shared with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and just because you would let me see it carefully, and maybe I would, you know, that would be the part of my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that the work that you put into it, the credit earn, would be lost at all.
Yeah. No, this is my only full copy, in a sense of.
Uh huh.
Yeah. Let me think about it.
But okay. Please.
Yeah. I'm not disinclined to do it. It's uh-huh. just I need to think about it.
Sure. I understand. I have conducted, like I told you earlier, mm-hmm. interviews with 65 individuals, mm-hmm. and even though I'm still working on my own publication, which is going to be a monograph, mm-hmm. I'm working with, like I told you before again, with two university libraries to donate my materials,
mm-hmm.
and it has crossed my mind that if somebody uses it, maybe my credential will be stolen by me, but I decided that that's not going to happen, mm-hmm. because it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And whatever other people might want to do using my oral history interviews, it's not going to be lost
mm-hmm.
that I am the mm-hmm. person who mm-hmm. conducted
right.
and created
right.
this material. So this is something for you to think
mm-hmm.
about, because like you said, it's very unique, valuable materials that should be available to people
mm-hmm.
who are seriously
mm-hmm.
interested in the history of the bomb survivors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'd be really happy if you give it a serious thought
okay.
and consideration.
And I don't know if most of the survivors, like Mrs., and I don't know if she has hers, but, you know, they were given a copy of their transcript.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if, you could, so, yeah. But in your request, let me think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But
I want this to be out there. I really do.
No, like I told you, it's like, yes, I know it's I believe it's important for these stories to be out there. but it's like to me, this is still like unfinished.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in the back of my mind, there's some Japanese words in the various transcripts, and I guess one sample I looked at, you know, there's a little appendix with all the translated words, and it's like, you know, I haven't done that, anyway.
Yeah,
so, and this is the result of a number of people. So, and I need to sit down and write down their names so that you know their work also gets acknowledged.
Right, You know, thinking about the remaining task that you think to be done with this, there are, like you did originally to initiate this interviews. There are funding sources that you may be able to apply
mm.
to have that work completed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to talk about that if you are interested in knowing more about it. I mean, I don't have money.
Yeah,
I'm just a public employee, but I have some knowledge about where to go to have that work done. I think it's very valuable, and it really should be preserved.
Yes.
It should be preserved.
I know. It's like, it's my paralysis here. That's at any rate, so.
Do you have any other materials? I mean, it could be something like this, or it could be, actually, I'll be interested in seeing any pictures that you might be willing to show me. You talked about this, going to meeting this peace activism or the anti-nuclear activism.
I don't have pictures of it. This is my story. This is the story board for the... or the story for the slideshow.
Oh.
And, I think it'd be nice to put it on something digital, but then it's like I need to get permission for music and stuff that I used here that I didn't get permission to do because I had to do this very quickly.
Oh.
But then the whole slideshow... Are excerpts from the transcripts and the tapes.
Uh-huh.
So we use the tapes for the for the voices on the slides. Yeah. So do I have names there? No. Oh yeah, just some. I don't know.
So those are the sources?
Oh, these are my sources. So,
I see.
So I know.
Transcript.
Yeah, so this would be from with her picture.
Mm-hmm.
So we had slides of the survivor so that it would go with parts of the interview.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I'll show this to you. Publicity poster for the slideshow. So this is the diary from I think it was her. This is Mrs. Shiroma. So then she had a diary. She did a diary. She would be something. She's one of the people I'm thinking of for the interview, but
may I take a picture of this poster?
Sure. It's a little faded, but...
It looks great.
Just do this now. Yeah, she's...
This is a little too big for me to scan in. I have this big of a space, but nothing bigger than that would fit in.
Do you have a little portable scanner?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Does that work well?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. So it traveled around quite a bit.
This is done so long ago.
Yeah.
Where did we go? We went to Windward, Honolulu, Maui, Kahului, and Leeward, Oahu. Okay, we didn't go to Maui, just Kauai. Yeah.
Do you remember anybody telling you, again, in the process of interviewing survivors, anything that sound really strikingly, uniquely American to you?
The survivors?
Yeah, I guess I'm asking you this because it's just fascinating that some of the survivors I interviewed on mainland, mm-hmm. they told me stories of how even during the wartime or even at the time of the bombing, they felt they belonged to both America and Japan, mm-hmm. which is not common among Japanese survivors, mm. obviously. So for example, some of them told me that, well, you know, B-29s, I thought that they're friends from America because I'm from America too. Uh-huh. I wasn't scared at all. Oh, I just I find this very striking.
When you were mentioning that, this came to mind. Let's see if I can find his. This was a. I'm trying to find this one. I don't have it here. And I don't know why. I'm not sure why. But, we misspelled her name. when I saw him 2 years ago, mm-hmm. his wife said that he was, I guess he has dementia. I don't know if he has Alzheimer's, but he has dementia. Uh-huh. And he's not coming this year because his wife didn't send in anything. But Mr. Sunita, he and his sister, she has since she died a while ago. Uh-huh. And I don't find his interview in here. But he. He mentioned that when they were living in Hawaii, and then his father worked at the Japanese consulate as some kind of groundskeeper, and so they were taken to the mainland. And then from the mainland ship to Japan, back to Japan.
Yeah, when the war started out. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So he was very young, and in Japan he would get in Hiroshima. He would get teased because he was an American, and you know he just got really upset about that. You know? So when you mentioned that about the American, and that's the only thing I can think about. That's the only. That's the only mention I think of. I haven't gone through this in such a long time. I've forgotten a lot of it. But you know, I think I just remembered him mentioning that.
Right.
You know, that he was being teased for being an American.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And you know, he would fight back. Scrappy little kid. Mm. Yeah. So things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I have had quite a few people who were teased by the Japanese kids. And other people were just really fine. I mean, it's really interesting mixture of different kinds of experiences.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I didn't ask them about was how did it feel being American, you know, at that time, or just during wartime, and then at that time and then afterwards in Japan. To some extent, my bias at this time was one was to get the story, but then also, you know, to kind of find out what their feelings were toward nuclear weapons, because you know, at that time that was, you know, part, that was a big issue at that time. It was a big issue. But so, you know, talking to you now, I was like, yeah, I didn't ask those kinds of questions because it didn't occur to me. I was a little too narrow.
I think it was just something that people were really interested in at the time, right? Mm-hmm. That's why I think it's crucial to have different sets of interviews from different eras, because it tells us not only about survivors themselves, but also the passage of time as interviewers changes over time. So what kind of question did you ask? Did you ask them how they think about the use of weapons and things
like that?
Yeah, that
was near
the
end. What did they feel? How did they feel about nuclear weapons at this time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of them were, some of them felt like, at that time it felt like, well, that was part of the war, part of wartime. And a lot of them kind of didn't have strong feelings against nuclear weapons, you know, although they were, part of it. They didn't develop any strong feelings against it. It was interesting for me to learn that.
Why do you think that? I'm asking you this because I hear that from many survivors too. Many of them say that, well, it was needed to end the war, which is surprising.
I hadn't heard
to
that,
me.
But it was like they just felt it was just part of the war. It was just part of the war. It was. It wasn't, something that happened in the war. I don't know. And I didn't want to push too far either at that time. You know, I didn't want to push too far because, just sometimes listening to their stories, it's like, oh, you know, my God. And a number of them, you know, this one gentleman, Mr. Psyche, who, I don't know if you already talked to him.
No.
When I was interviewing him and he was, recalling, looking for his father, and he got all choked up. And so it was like, well, you know, it's like, whoa, that's really deep, you know. And this is still like 40 years after. So deep, deep for them. So, interesting. Yeah. So I don't know.
Now, I guess I have. I've been staying here. I have to go back to the Oahu Island this afternoon. But I'll be staying here for a while into the next week. I have right now Monday afternoon open in my schedule, and I can probably make some time at one point on Wednesday as well. Mm-hmm. Wednesday afternoon probably works out for me.
Okay. Do you want me to call?
If you feel comfortable with, I mean, it's really.
I can call and see if she's willing. See, I don't know her story either, so and if you're here, you can talk to her. So
sure, okay.
Okay, let me go.
We also have a community of people from Micronesia whose islands were used for nuclear weapon testing.
Of course, of course.
So here on this island, there's quite a large, you know, the Micronesians can come as under the compacts of free association. They can come to the United States and live here. And so we have a large population of Micronesians, including from the Marshall Islands.
Right.
So there's a community down in actually southern part of this island from Manawatak. Mm. Which was one of the islands used for the nuclear weapon testing.
Wow. How many people who are survivors do you think are here?
I'm not exactly sure. There's a movie, maybe 200, 300, I'm not sure. And so someone made a movie starring one of those survivors. I'll write down the information.
That would be useful,
because
yeah.
It's you can see the preview of it.
Uh-huh.
So it's been shown around. It's a low budget.
Sure.
But it was done by a young guy who's a graduate of the University of Southern California School of Filmmaking.
Yes,
so he's
yes.
knowledgeable. And so he went down there, and then the idea evolved, and the guy who was the actor kind of helped create the story.
Huh, that's
and
fascinating.
So it's called The Land of Ebb.
Land of...
I'll write it down for
okay,
you.
Okay, okay.
And the website, there's a website for it, so you can check it out.
Oh, of course, I love it.
And so I know Jonathan, the man who's the actor, and he's sort of one of the main leaders of the community. And it's, they are not, he's pretty cagey, not any, you can't just put him in your pocket. He's smart, and so he knows how to deal with people, and so he kind of keeps his distance. But I recently saw him. They had an exhibit of art from that community at the university, and so he was there, and so we had a very nice conversation.
Do you know if this Polynesian survivors group and the Japanese American or Hawaiian survivors group have any communication or collaborative relationship?
I'm surely positive there is none.
Why is that the case, I wonder?
Well, I guess they're sort of different. These survivors were people who were in Hiroshima, so the issues are somewhat different. I mean, these folks were removed from their island, and they, you know, their culture is all involved with that. And then they were.
I see.
And it's complicated because there were fallout from one of those explosions did fall on some of the. On some island, I forget the detail. Was it Rongelap?
Okay.
And so they are exposed.
Oh.
But the survivors, you know, are here. They're only, I think, this is, you know, an older group to begin with. And they're focused on, so I think they're not thinking in those kind of terms.
Yeah. But it's...
And still, these folks from Micronesia are... similarly or not, or, you know, they're a small perspective.
I see. But that's very strange that there are two groups of people whose lives are so affected by irradiation or the bomb, I should say.
Well, it doesn't seem strange to me. I mean, just you know, knowing the those folks somewhat, just that they're... perspectives aren't, I mean, they're not political or not, I guess, looking at it in a big perspective.
You were interested in the anti-nuclear movement,
yeah,
right?
Me and I were involved in the...
Yeah. How, where did your interest come from, originally speaking?
let's see, we were involved with the Quakers, the American Friends Service uh-huh. Committee had an office in Honolulu. And, uh-huh. So activists there, the focus became the nuclear weapons storage at West Lock of Pearl Harbor. So that was a major, there was a big campaign focusing on protesting nuclear weapons storage. And then, so May and I were involved in that. And then there was the nuclear-free and independent Pacific movement. Mm-hmm. So May and I were involved in that.
Could you please tell me a little more about that movement, particularly what goals that it tries to accomplish?
Boy, that was around, I guess, 1980. And I think uh-huh. that's how May first heard about the survivors here.
Uh-huh. Yeah, she was telling me earlier, yeah.
And I'd have to really think back. We probably have literature on it somewhere. But it was focusing on the, because there were still a lot of the independence movements of the Pacific, so it wasn't clear what was going to happen to Micronesia mm-hmm. And so forth. That was before the compacts of free association that mm-hmm. set them up as independent countries.
Right.
But let's see, I think there were other places in the Pacific that were still striving for independence
uh-huh.
also.
Uh-huh, yeah. So the political independence, so mm-hmm. to speak, was sort of tied up with your interest in nuclear-free world?
So that, the way that movement evolved, that was the bringing those two things together.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So that would, for getting rid of getting the nuclear weapons out of the Pacific.
Right.
So that would bring in that focus on nuclear weapons at West Lock of Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm. So it was both local, but also it had a sort of broader, expansive goals.
So this conference brought in, I guess they got some grant money from somewhere, so we met out on the North Shore on Oahu
uh-huh.
at some camp, I think YMCA camp or something.
And uh-huh.
So we had people there from, all over the Pacific.
Mm-hmm. It must have been, in many ways, exciting time because there are many people who are very much involved in anti-nuclear movement, like the one mm-hmm. that you were involved in yourself.
And so out of that conference, there was an office established that kind of coordinated the nuclear-free and Pacific work for several years.
Mm. Yeah.
And there was one of the key organizers in organizing the conference was the group called the Micronesian Support Committee. And a woman and her son were the key players in that. Her husband was a history professor at UH Manoa.
Uh-huh.
And then she was, I guess, a longtime activist.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And her name was Betty Johnson. Then her son, Gift Johnson, he married one of the Marshallese women.
Oh.
And they moved to the Marshall Islands.
Uh-huh.
And he's still there as the editor of the main newspaper in the Marshall Islands.
Uh-huh. It's just fascinating connections that people have.
Yeah. I'll let you.
Please give me a reference to the film that you mentioned.
I will. Yeah,
I'll
write all that down for you.
Yeah,
I was talking about the
Land of Em.
Land of
Em. Why are you laughing?
No. That's just so we're film keeps coming up.
Yeah, I keep writing it up. Made a big impression on me. I'll write that down.
Yeah, thank you.
I called Mrs. Goto and she said no.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yeah. Thank you for trying anyway.
I asked her. I'm not trying to pressure anything, but why? Because I told her that, other people, when they're asked, some of them say no. And she said, And she said, I don't like to be part of any survey or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, that's fine.
No, yeah. That's fine. Yeah.
And it's a good thing I called her too, because she hadn't taken her blood tests. And oh no, this year it's different. You got to do this earlier. So I got her to. So she's going in.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. You never
and
know.
And I tried calling the other person, but she doesn't answer. So I can call later, but I just no luck there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but I'm glad that now she's aware of what she has to do. At least it was just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was unusual for her when I found out that she hadn't gone in yet. I know, well, maybe she's not coming, so.
Yeah. But, it's amazing. Sometimes you send a letter and then you thought that you already communicated with this person, but somehow the information wasn't fully communicated.
I need to do a Japanese version of the letters I send out, I think.
Is that so?
I think so, because I don't know whether it's because it's just too many words, and so, it's too much to read.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been so used to us doing the exams a certain way. With next year, I mean, if we go through it next year, it's going to change again. So it's like, I do need to kind of change, need to get it changed. That's why Mrs. Kusama has been so helpful, because she can speak Japanese.
Yeah.
She can explain to them.
Right.
Needs to be done.
But your impression is that most of the people who come for checkup, they just prefer to speak in Japanese, or they feel more comfortable.
They feel more comfortable there.
Yeah.
Let's see. Yeah, because a couple of the ones I've had to talk to, it's like, I can't explain to them because they don't know very much English, and whatever I'm trying to say it in as simple and as clear as I can, and it's still not coming through. So it's like, I need to.
Yeah, I was just taking a look of it while you were talking. Thank you.
Yeah, I need to find that missing one.
The one that had
me.
The human being
story,
teeth.
Yeah. Well, because he had, another interesting. I'm sorry, but another interesting thing he and his sister. It was his older sister. So his older sister kind of took care of him.
Mm-hmm.
And she was badly he was badly burned, they had heard, her sister had heard, that if they mix their mother's ashes, because the mother had died previously, earlier, I don't know how many years before, someone told them that if they mix their mother's ashes with some kind of oil or ointment and then put it on his burnt arm, that would help the healing. And so that's what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like, oh boy.
Yeah.
I mean, for the family to do something like that.
Yeah.
To do something like that. It's like, wow.
Yeah. It's just incredible stories that
you think about these people having to go through this and live through this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Yeah.
May I write down my maybe cell phone number on my name card so that you'll have
them
both?
You can do it. So I have it. But I will, if you don't mind, maybe email you in terms of what, how best to save this. And it's not something I'm ready to kind of do right now, but
okay.
If I could, it's kind of like for me right now, I need to get through the exams.
Sure.
Then I can just put that behind me and not worry about,
sure.
Doing all that.
Yeah.
But then that'll kind of give me a clear idea of what I need to do with this to get it ready for, to get it kept somewhere or kept and shared somehow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about how, you know, for in case of your slides, you didn't get permission for some songs or images that you used. That's the difference between publishing something mm-hmm. and donating something to the academic archive. If it's an archival donation, it's not going to be required mm-hmm. that you clear all of those things.
It's not go public.
No. It's going to be accepted as is. Mm-hmm. That's part of the value of mm-hmm. historical sources. Mm-hmm. So, if you want to know more of those details,
I'll try to figure out some people who I might contact in terms of locally what archiving, you know, mm-hmm. might be done for this. Yeah.
And if you, let's say...
Sorry, it's our little cat. He wants in.
He's curious.
He wants in.
Cats are like
when he hears us here, he's like, okay, time to let them know.
Yeah.
Let's see. Keep talking. I'm listening. I know I'm being rude, but...
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah, but if you digitize it, it's not as though you have to decide on one archive that you want to contribute. You can decide as many archives you want.
Ah.
Yeah.
Rosie, can you come in? It's okay. You hesitant? You know that. Okay, we'll leave you all for now.